I'm Jill Kaufman, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The question of whether the harsh interrogation tactic known as waterboarding is torture or not dominated Attorney General Michael Mukasey's first congressional hearing this morning. The topic crowded out discussions of other issues like warrantless spying on Americans and the firings of U.S. attorneys last year. Time after time today, senators pressed Mukasey for an answer on waterboarding. Here's Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy.
Would waterboarding be torture if it was done to you?
I would feel that it was.
Mukasey dodged the question of whether waterboarding is legal by saying that the technique is no longer being used. 3 months ago, Mukasey narrowly won confirmation as Attorney General after refusing to state his opinion then. Joining us on the line from outside the Senate hearing room is Evan Perez, who covers the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal. Evan Perez, what struck you most about today's hearing?
Well, I think despite the fact that he's refusing to answer the question of whether waterboarding is torture and therefore illegal, I think Judge Mukasey, former federal judge, is getting pretty good treatment from a very skeptical group of senators.
So he's evasive, but not infuriating them.
That's right. I mean, it's unlike the former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, when he evaded questions and he refused to answer or said I don't know, that infuriated them. Mukasey is a lot more careful, is a lot more precise. It's clear that he knows a lot of about the law and that he has researched this issue. And he's just in a very tight spot, and apparently, because of what he's seen, he can't or he won't respond to the question.
Okay. I'd like to get to some specific reactions today, or how he reacted to the congressman. The CIA and the Pentagon banned waterboarding in 2006, but before that, it was used on some terrorism suspects. So today, Senator Kennedy asked Mukasey if waterboarding has been placed on the list of fundamentally illegal interrogation activities. What did Mukasey say?
In response to that, it was one of those cases where the judge uses very carefully scripted language, and essentially doesn't get to answer the question, and that is one of these great examples where he goes in a roundabout way to sort of suggest that he cannot say what was used by the CIA or what was used by the military and whether that applies to what the CIA might be using.
But at this point, now that he's been confirmed, why is he so hesitant to give his opinion on waterboarding if it's no longer being done?
Well, according to the to him and according to the administration, it's still classified. Whether or not the CIA actually used the methods or not, they believe that by discussing any specific methods and by declaring them to be legal or illegal, it perhaps gives terror suspects the means to prepare for any interrogation methods. Of course, that seems kind of a far-fetched excuse, simply because we've discussed this so much. I mean, the world knows what we've discussed. And if anybody, even in a cave in Afghanistan, doesn't know about this, then that would be very surprising.
No, I know that while this is no longer on the list of torture, supposedly, this is still part of another investigation. And Republican Senator Arlen Specter today pressed Mukasey on the once secret program also to wiretap Americans without court-ordered warrants as required by law. Senator Specter wanted to know whether the president could ignore the prohibition on waterboarding as he did wiretap laws. And what did Mukasey have to say to that?
Again, it's one of those cases where he just wouldn't go there. And essentially, Mukasey's response to this is that the president has Article II powers that allows him under circumstances to contravene some of the laws that are put forth by the Congress. And in this case, there's a law that FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which would prohibit some of these surveillance activities, but Mukasey endorses the president has some powers that allows him to contravene some of those laws.
Evan Perez, I don't know if you can answer this briefly, but is this issue sidetracking him and senators from getting on with other Justice Department business? And we only have a few seconds.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, we will continue to watch this. Thank you so much for joining us. Evan Perez covers the Justice Department for The Wall Street Journal.
Thank you.
New York City voted last week to force major fast food chains to post calorie information on their menus. CKE Restaurants, which owns the Hardee's and Carl's Jr. burger chain, says bring it on. The chain revels in advertising its high-calorie, high-fat burgers. Take the Carl's Jr. double $6 burger. It weighs in at more than 1,500 calories. It has 111 grams of fat and 1 pound of beef. And then there's the Philly cheesesteak burger. Basically, it's a hamburger with a cheesesteak sub on top at merely 930 calories. Condé Nast Portfolio profiles CKE in its February issue, and it focuses on the company's marketing strategy of going fatter while other fast food chains are slimming down. Andy Puzder is chief executive of CKE. He says his company is giving customers what they want.
I look at my job as not trying to determine what people want to eat and then making them eat it. I try and find out what they want to eat and then sell it to them. Now, we do have healthy alternative products in the store. We have a really great charbroiled chicken sandwich that's 4 grams of fat and it's on a honey whole wheat bun. We have salads. We have products you can eat that are healthy. We just don't sell a lot of them, and not a lot of people eat those products in our restaurants. So we have the big, juicy, delicious products. We post in the restaurants what the fat content is on them. It's on our website. And when we issue a press release, we even put in the press releases what the fat and caloric content of these burgers are. So we're not trying to hide it. And, in fact, Jay Leno often jokes about our products on The Tonight Show. You know, we want them to talk about what's in them. He talks about what they're made up of, and he makes a joke about it, and you know, we sell a bunch of them. People seem to like that.
Any press is good press.
There's that. Almost any press. You know, you watch the elections, you realize that not all press is good press, but pretty close. Yeah, I mean, you're not too far off. You know, there's a lot of talk now about disclosing fat content and caloric content, and you know, we brag about it. We don't care about it. We're not ashamed to disclose it. We think our products are decadently good. We don't do little, we do delicious.
Well, you know, so there's corporate responsibility in all sectors now in terms of, you know, green energy, for instance. Do you think there's any corporate responsibility on a fast food chain's part to not develop such caloric, high-fat content?
Well, I think what you have to do is you have to offer people healthy alternatives, and we do that. I think if you eat right and you exercise and you do the things that you should do to maintain your health, you should have every right to eat whatever products you want to eat. And if your health is bad and and you're overweight, then you should be more concerned about what you eat. But that's not something I think that the government has a responsibility or any division of food police has the authority to tell people in this country. I think you get to decide what you want to eat and when you want to eat it and how you want to eat it. And I wouldn't change that one bit.
Do you eat your own products from the company?
Oh, man, all the time, yeah.
Well, how often?
Well, I probably eat at Carl's or Hardee's about 4 or 5 times a week. And I'll get a $6 burger on one or two of those occasions.
And how much exercise do you need to be able to work that burger off?
I probably run, I jog 2-3 times a week, and I'll probably do weights probably an average of twice a week.
So you're a pretty active fellow.
I do my best.
You know, this is so idiosyncratic because obviously, you know, I don't know what else you eat on the day that you eat that $6 burger and the fries and the Diet Coke. I mean, you might decide, well, that's it for the day. I've had enough. And that's you. But out there, most folks who are buying fast food, they're just eating a meal. Who is your clientele for these large burgers, these really sumptuous ones?
Our advertising target is young, hungry guys, 17 or 18 to 34 or 35, kind of in that range. And they eat about half the burgers. They're about half the burger business in the country. And, you know, they're growing or they're working construction jobs or, you know, they're out there with something that's very vigorous. And at the end of the day, they don't want to eat, you know, applesauce and a burger that you have to open the bun to find the meat. They want a big, juicy, delicious, wonderful product, and we want to have it for them.
So another area of criticism for your company is the commercials that are on television right now. There's one featuring Paris Hilton in rather skimpy clothes, and she's washing a car, and she occasionally takes a bite of a mammoth burger. And then there's this one, which has a young woman riding a mechanical bull with a hamburger in her hand.
Carl's Jr., Western Bacon, $6 burger.
That was my favorite ads. I thought it was a sexy ad. I thought it was an ad that really drew attention to the product and to the attitude of the company. I thought it was a very good ad for us. It was very effective. We spend, you know, Burger King, Wendy's spend about $300-400 million a year in advertising. McDonald's spends about $800 million a year. At Carl's, we spend like $50 million a year, and at Hardee's, $75 million. So it's $125 million. We really have to have ads that you will remember, that are likable, that appeal to our demographic. You know, I can't do, I'm liking it, they're liking it, somebody's liking it all day long. You've seen it so many times, by the end of the day, you say, hey, maybe I am liking it. You know, I can't do that. I got to do one ad that you'll remember. And these ads are the kind of ads that really stick with people and that really appeal to our demographic. Young, hungry guys are probably stopping for our ads so they can see them, as opposed to, you know, fast-forwarding through them. So these are the kinds of ads I think we need to do to remain competitive with these much larger national chains. But we do have a target that we've picked. I can't compete, nor do I try and compete with McDonald's, for example, for women and kids. I mean, you know, women and kids are their target. And they got a lot of money to spend on it. And if I want to compete meaningfully, I need to pick a target that distinguishes us from them. And I think our ads do that, and our products do that, and the attitude of the brand does that.
I wonder, on the part of your company, if there's also a social conscience, given what is happening among children, at least in the school-age children in America, and adults as well, in terms of obesity. Is there any time that you stop and say, wow, we shouldn't make these as fattening as they are. Wow, these burgers are so good, and maybe, you know, maybe we should back off on the pedal a bit.
You know, first of all, we don't advertise to kids. Our advertising is not intended
but they're
to
appeal watching.
To children at all. If children come in, we do have, you know, chicken strips and chicken stars, and as I said, we have the great Charbroiled chicken sandwiches and salads and things that, and orange juice and milk and things that people can eat if they choose to eat in a healthy way. But, you know, Chinese food has MSG. Steaks, when you go to a big steak restaurant, have a lot of calories and a lot of fat. I don't want somebody telling me I can't go get those products. The job of American business isn't to regulate what people eat. We want to give people delicious, good products that they can choose to eat. And if they choose to eat healthy products, I want to have those products so they can choose to eat them. This is what individual freedom is all about.
Andy Puzder is chief executive of CKE, the parent company of Hardee's and Carl's Jr. Burger Chains. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Jill.
We'll be back in a minute to hear more about CKE's Mega Burgers with Joe Cohane, a reporter who visited the company's test kitchens in California and writes about the trend toward fatter fast food in the February edition of Condé Nast Portfolio magazine. Later in the show, John Edwards and Rudy Giuliani bow out of the presidential race. We'll talk politics with Matt Bai of the New York Times Magazine. You're listening to Here and Now. We're back with more on America's appetite for bigger, fatter burgers. Sandwiches like CKE Restaurant's Double Western Cheeseburger. It's two beef patties, bacon, cheese, barbecue sauce, and even onion rings on top of the burger. And you'd have to jog about an hour and a half to work off the 970 calories. Joe Cohane wrote about the trend toward fatter fast food for Condé Nast Portfolio magazine. Joe Cohane, before the break, we heard from the CKE chief executive, Andy Puzder. What's your take on him?
Puzder, first of all, is an extremely savvy man. His media savvy is unbelievable, like you mentioned when you've spoken to him. He's great at kind of exploiting people's mortal horror of the products that he creates, getting a lot of buzz for him, and he's so unapologetic about, you know, the magnitude, the caloric magnitude of some of these items, that it becomes kind of a selling point for him. It's not something to be ashamed of. It's something that's actually used, you know, to attract customers, whereas a lot of other fast food chains are, you know, at least in the last few years, have sort of shied away from that sort of disclosure, I guess.
Right. I mean, you know, we heard of Super Size Me and we heard of Fast Food Nation back earlier in 2004, 2003. But why should he feel any responsibility? I mean, this is a corporation. They're out there making money. This is what they do. They're selling hamburgers, however they can, just like many other corporations selling their products. So why should anybody think that he should be responsible?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's the question. You know, it's I was joking with their marketing guy about how this is a triumph of Jeffersonian democracy. democracy over anything else. It's this idea that people are, you know, more than capable of taking care of themselves and making their own decisions. And if they want to make a decision that's detrimental to their health, then, you know, this is America. You have the right to do that. And if a company's around to make money off that, then they have every right to do that as well. Something in you screams that people shouldn't be eating this stuff and people shouldn't be selling it, and there's something like clearly wrong going on. But at the same time, you want to allow people to make their own choices and make their own mistakes and just kind of let it roll like that.
You know, I understand you went to the CKE corporate headquarters and you sampled some of the food at the test kitchen. Where was the headquarters and how was the food?
The headquarters is in Carpinteria, California, which is it's about an hour north of L.A. I spent about an hour in the test kitchen at corporate headquarters. I probably ate about 4 pounds of their food.
Did you take little bites of things, or you ate an entire burger?
I really ate. I ate most of it, I'd say. And I'm not a fast food guy, so this was a complete and utter shock to my system. I won't even tell you how this story ended at the Long Beach Airport. But no, the food actually tasted, you know, it tasted good. A good deal better than McDonald's, better than Burger King.
When you walked into the kitchen, what did it smell like? I mean, was it a barbecue smell? Was it a...
Yeah, it smelled like a fast food joint. You know, it didn't smell like a grease pot or anything like that. They obviously keep it really clean. This is where they test, and this is where they develop all their items. But, you know, I spent some time at a Hardee's down in Mississippi, and it kind of smelled the same way. It just smelled like a fast food place.
Do you have a sense of, in terms of the industry, why CKE can move forward with now making bigger, fatter burgers when a lot of other fast food restaurants are tailoring back, they're making healthier offerings, and they were being sued for offering fat fare?
Around 2003, 2004, that's when there was a real backlash against fast food in America. And there was a period where fast food chains had to pretend, if only for a moment, to care about the health of their customers. So you'll see that we're at a point now where they're sort of past that. A lot of those guys will still offer healthy alternatives. You go to Burger King's website and there's a link to something about how to make Burger King food like a part of your healthy lifestyle, which is preposterous because if you want a healthy lifestyle, Burger King should play no role in it. But the thing with CKE is that they were so far ahead of the curve on this. You know, you see a lot of fast food places now that are putting out these monstrous, you know, really large burgers, Wendy's, Burger King particularly. CKE started doing this stuff in like 2000, you know, and ran right through this period of political correctness where everyone was kind of running scared. And, you know, they basically zigged when everyone else zagged, and they did really well with it.
Are they affecting now other chain food restaurants? Is there a trend now to go back to the larger way?
Yeah, there's a trend definitely to go back to gigantic burgers. I mean, you'll see it with Wendy's Baconator, which is this huge burger with just a mound of bacon on top of the thing that you could say was presaged by CKE's like pastrami burger, which is this absolutely gigantic burger with a huge pile of pastrami on it, you know.
Any idea the caloric value of these?
Not off the top of my head, but I guarantee it's shocking. But you're seeing a lot of these guys get into the big burger game, and the burgers now are bigger than they've ever been in the past, which is funny. It kind of stands as a repudiation of the political correct movement that happened in the early years of this decade. But to prove causality, I mean, I spoke to some product development people at some of the other restaurants, and they just said this is what the customer wants. But there was a time when CKE was kind of fearless and audacious enough to really give the customer what it wants and not really worry about the political correctness of it, and at the same time really exploit people's resentment of the political correctness. You know, really kind of exploit people's resentment of the fact that people who don't know them are telling them how to eat all the time.
Andy Puzder maintains that CKE, when they're selling these burgers, they're not marketing them to kids. They're marketing them to hungry men, hungry strapping men who need their beef and need their onion rings. But how can they get away with this kind of marketing, selling these burgers the way they are, when kids are likely watching these TV programs too?
Right. I mean, they've insulated themselves against that line of criticism because they really don't advertise directly to children. They don't have a cartoon clown beckoning the kids. They don't necessarily do Happy Meals that they really advertise. They'll have kids' meals at the restaurant, but it never enters their marketing materials, their ads, or anything like that. So that, I mean, that's big. That's really big for them because it could be catastrophic if they were seen as like targeting children with this stuff. So that definitely helps them out. I mean, the way that they insulate themselves from a lot of the trouble that their competitors have found themselves in is kind of ingenious. Like, for one, there's an assumption he uses the phrase the food police, I'd say the anti-obesity lobby or something like that. There's an assumption that the only reason people eat fast food is because they don't know how bad it is for them. And that was an assumption kind of aired around Super Size Me and with some of those books and things like that. So they cut that off at the pass by just advertising how bad this stuff is for you. Not even disclosing it, but actively glorying in it, you know, bragging about it, laughing about it. So that's one thing that gets them. The second thing is that their burgers are like, you know, it can be $4, $5, something like that. So they also, while other fast food restaurants are getting killed for, you know, basically hurting the poor, hurting the economically disadvantaged who can't afford a proper night out, who need to, you know, only have $3 to spend on dinner, you can't really apply that to them either because they charge more for their stuff. The median income of a Carl's Jr. customer is like $75,000, which is unbelievable. And Carl's is, it's a California chain, so obviously California is going to be a richer state than the rest of, a lot of the rest of the country. Hardee's is mostly in the Southeast, though it's kind of all over the country. Their average income, I'm not sure what the number is off the top of my head, but it's considerably lower. That's more of a blue-collar target demographic for them.
You know, I wonder also what their success says about American culture. You were leading into something before regarding, like, it's big, it's bad, can you take it? You know, can you eat this burger? Can you suffer its calories? I mean, is that part of our culture, in your opinion, as a journalist?
I mean, it's a component of the culture, obviously. You know, it's an expression of manliness to be able to knock one of these things down. And the irony is that it's probably going to shorten your lifespan by about 20 years.
Joe Cohane wrote the article Fat Profits for Condé Nast Portfolio Magazine. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, talking politics in the workplace, what's legal, what's ethical, and should the laws change? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the New York Times' Matt Bai on presidential politics. That's right after a break, Here and Now. As Super Tuesday approaches, the landscape of the presidential race continues to shift. The big news today, reports that Democrat John Edwards is dropping out of the race after several disappointing finishes in the early contests, and Republican Rudy Giuliani is also expected to drop out after placing third in Florida yesterday. John McCain won the GOP primary in the Sunshine State over Mitt Romney, and he's now emerging as the Republican frontrunner. And Democrat Hillary Clinton is trumpeting her Florida win, even though for now she's not going to get any delegates from the victory. Joining us to talk about all this is Matt Bai, contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. His most recent book on the state of politics is timely. It's called The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers, and the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Matt Bai, first to the candidates who are in the news today because they're dropping out, John Edwards and Rudy Giuliani. What's your take on this?
Well, I mean, Jill, I'm less surprised about Giuliani, obviously, because you could sort of see this coming for a while. I mean, in a sense, you know, partly Giuliani appears to have fallen precipitously because he was doing so well in a lot of national polls earlier on. But, you know, national polls are kind of meaningless in a primary campaign, and I think that was a little illusory. I think the bigger problem for Giuliani really had to do with the changing dynamic around the war and terrorism, the changing issues of the campaign, and that landscape, which was pretty favorable to him as recently as last summer, became much more difficult. The whole rationale for his campaign has essentially been undermined. And then, on the Edwards side, you know, he never really found his niche. There was probably room for one, a real alternative to Hillary Clinton. It became increasingly obvious in the last couple months that Senator Obama was filling that space. And there was always just something sort of, you know, dark about the Edwards campaign this time. I mean, I called it in a profile last summer. I referred to it as Twilight in America, and a lot of people didn't like that. But there was something in that populist strain that Edwards was adhering to. That was sort of pessimistic and dark.
But what's the darkness, though? It's not clear.
Well,
this populism.
In the sense that what, you know, he was just, it was always about things that were bad and things that were wrong. I mean, even in his speeches, when he got up after he lost in Iowa and New Hampshire, he got up and the first thing he talked about within 2 minutes was a guy with a cleft palate and couldn't get medical care. And so it was a very unorthodox way of giving a concession speech. There was a personal missionary zeal to Edwards' campaign. I think he felt it very deeply. I think that what had happened in his own life and in his own career drove him to do this, but it was not an uplifting vision. And campaigns like that generally have a ceiling in American politics and in Democratic politics. There's an audience for it. They play a role. It's often a constructive role. It does shape the conversation, but it generally has a ceiling in terms of how successful it can be overall.
Mm. You know, we hear that Edwards, a progressive candidate, is apparently not endorsing anyone, but do you see a natural move for his supporters who they may gravitate toward as a candidate?
You know, I don't, and there are people smarter than me about this, and I'm sure there's a lot of polling and data, so I wouldn't, just because I don't doesn't mean there isn't. It's quite possible that there's a clear path here, but it seems to me, just you know, as an observer, that it's very hard to game that out. I mean, some of Edwards' support is probably the kind of very partisan progressives or you know, white Southerners who would not necessarily vote for Obama. At the same time, Obama has not been as, you know, avidly partisan as a lot of progressives would like him to be. At the same time, a lot of Edwards' support is anti-establishment and would seem to be very ambivalent about Senator Clinton and would probably gravitate toward Obama. So to me, it feels like a wash watching it from the outside,
And it may depend state by state.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to Giuliani for just a moment. Let me throw this quote at you on Politico.com today. Ben Smith and David Paul Kuhn write that Rudy Giuliani's distant third place finish in Florida may put an end to his bid for president. And it seems also to mark the beginning of the end of a period in Republican politics that began on September 11th, 2001. Does that make sense to you? And does that say anything about the state of politics right now, where this race goes?
That strikes me right off as a bit of an overstatement because we don't know where world events are headed. I mean, if there's a lesson in Giuliani's campaign, it should be more that we don't know where one era begins and one ends. There are fluctuations in that are outside the control of politicians. And Giuliani really ran as the guy who was going to clean up a mess in Iraq. You know, he ran as this tough guy, this surly, difficult personality. You may not love me, you may not agree with me on all the social issues, but man, I'm going to clean up Iraq because I could clean up New York, and I'm going to keep us safe from terrorists because I've dealt with all these bad guys in my life. And that was a more compelling case, I think, for a lot of the conservatives he was meeting in Iowa when I was with him, following him, last summer, than it was once the casualty rates in Iraq began to come down and there wasn't a daily headline about this disaster in Iraq and the threat of terrorism. And that could change again. The parties could nominate people based on the economy and. I certainly hope not. We all do. But, there could be another terrorist incident or there could be an uptick in violence in Iraq. I mean, so I don't think we've seen necessarily the end of an era, but we've seen the end of a moment and a change that did not play well for him.
If Giuliani goes ahead and does endorse McCain, as many are saying, he's endorsing a war veteran. He's endorsing another tough guy. Does that play forward? Does that bring those Republicans around?
Yeah, there's a natural bridge between those two guys. I mean, they've always liked each other. My recollection is that Giuliani endorsed McCain in 2000 in New York. I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure that's right. They have come from a similar sort of branch of Republican politics, and so I don't think that's an unnatural alliance by any means. And a lot of Giuliani supporters will probably gravitate pretty easily to McCain. The interesting thing where the war is concerned and where, as I was talking about these unforeseen events, is that while McCain is just as tough on these issues as Giuliani and has just been as avid a supporter of the war and as avid a foe of terrorism in a military sense, he also is so heavily identified with the war in Iraq, was such a champion of it from the beginning, that should things go bad in Iraq or take a turn for the worse, I think McCain is much more vulnerable to fallout from that than Giuliani is.
All right, let's look at the Democrats. Barack Obama is now the Kennedy torchbearer for the next generation. He was endorsed by Senator Ted Kennedy and also President Kennedy's daughter, Caroline. She talks about why she supports Barack Obama in a new TV ad. Let's just take a quick listen.
Once we had a president who made people feel hopeful about America and brought us together to do great things. Today, Barack Obama gives us that same chance. He makes us believe in ourselves again. That when we
just a taste of that. With this endorsement, Matt Bai, do you think something has shifted for the Democratic Party?
Well, I do think there's a moment of peril here for Hillary Clinton that goes beyond simply Ted Kennedy or Caroline Kennedy's endorsement, which is she is sort of the establishment candidate, and she's enjoyed the support of a lot of people who may not have a great personal affection for her or may not think she's necessarily even the best electable candidate, but, who are with her because they feel obligated to be with her, because they were Clinton people or because they're establishment people and they want jobs or whatever it is. And whenever a candidate's in that situation, the danger you face is that if there's a tipping point, if somebody else gets enough momentum where it looks like they could actually be the nominee, you can start to lose people, and you can start to lose, if you look at the endorsements over the last couple of weeks, Obama has not caught up to Hillary Clinton in endorsements, but he has some very impressive, particularly red state endorsements. He has a lot of Senate endorsements, a lot of gubernatorial endorsements. And what it really means is that a lot of people in the party establishment might start to waver if they feel as if the momentum is shifting the other way. And I don't think that's happening yet. But
Matt Bai, hold that thought for just a moment. I want to get to those endorsements. Matt Bai is the contributing writer for The New York Times. He's here with us on Here and Now. You're listening to Here and Now. Your last book, your most recent book also, called The Argument, it's about the battle to remake democratic politics.
It's my only book,
it's
Jill.
Your only book, but not your last book.
Let's hope not, right?
Well, what is the, I want to get to those endorsements in a second, but what is this democratic argument? Or maybe what should I say, what is the strategy? And does the Obama-Kennedy connection fit into it?
Well, what's interesting to me about that is that I think in a way it's certainly, there's no question, it's a huge positive for Obama in a primary campaign to have these Kennedy endorsements. It was a huge boost for him, and Ted Kennedy gave a tremendous speech the other day. The irony is that in a way it runs counter to his core argument, which is that we need to stop fighting the battles from the 60s, which is that this entire generation of baby boomers who've come before have so polarized Washington and politics with their culture wars and their repetitive fights that it's impossible to really solve problems. And Obama's whole notion is to get beyond these divisions that began on campuses essentially in the 1960s. And yet here he is reaching back and getting this big boost from the icons of that generation and the icons of that moment. And it was interesting in that regard, I think, that Ted Kennedy talked really, and David Brooks, my colleague on the op-ed page, pointed this out.
Yes, I read that.
That you know, he talked so much about the early 60s, more than he did, say, about 1968. And I think that's Obama's really trying to go back to that moment, but his campaign is really rooted in loosening the party from these cultural and historical bonds of 1968.
Right, and I don't know if it was you or David Brooks who called Obama the Top Gun candidate, meaning his cultural icons. He was born after this happened. This was not what he was living through.
I think that's me, unless Brooks did it too.
You know, I've been reading so much.
I did say in an essay this weekend that I called it the Top Gun generation, that, you know, Obama is really more my generation, although he's technically a boomer, but his formative experiences are very different. And he does represent a generational shift in the sense that, you know, even if he loses, even if he proves not to be the strong enough candidate he needs to be, or you know, even if he's blown away on Super Tuesday, whatever else happens, he has you know, kicked in the door for a new generation of political talent that will be coming along in much the same way that John Kennedy did in 1916, that Gary Hart did in 1984.
Well, let's talk about that. Super Tuesday obviously is coming up. More than 20 states will be voting. You know, something like half of the delegates for the conventions this summer will be chosen. But it's these super delegates who really impact candidates and their chance to become the nominee. Can you describe that? Who are these super delegates?
Yeah.
What role they play?
Well, they don't normally command that much influence, but this year we're certainly headed in that direction. The super delegates were created after 1980. Basically, a lot of Democratic Party people got together and said we have to rig the system a little bit so these insurgents can't come and just take the nomination away. So they devised this thing called superdelegates, and that is basically elected officials, senators, governors, party chairmen, influential activists. There's something close to 1,000 of them, somewhere between 800 and 1,000 of them, and they have a vote as delegates in the process that is completely unrelated to what happens in primaries and caucuses, and I think they have about a fifth of the total delegate count. So in a very close race, it really is the party establishment that still gets to decide the outcome. We've not had a race that close since 1984. The superdelegates probably enabled Walter Mondale to get that nomination. It's not clear that he would have been able to without them.
How is it that Bill Clinton is actually a superdelegate?
I don't know the answer to that. Probably, I guess if you're a former president,
yes, I think that might be it.
Just get that status. And these are, you know, this is like the rules of, this is like Kremlinology here. There's about six people on the planet who understand all of the intricacies of the mm-hmm. superdelegates mm-hmm. and the process. And by the way, they like it that way.
Well, let's get back to those endorsements for just a moment. We have about a minute left. Isn't Hillary Clinton representing the Democratic establishment? May she get those superdelegates, especially if her husband is one of them?
Well, she certainly should lay claim to the superdelegates. Him, I would guess, and many others. That is certainly the working theory, is that the superdelegates would always benefit Hillary Clinton because she is the establishment candidate. But, you know, as I point out in the essay this Sunday, we live in a very different world now, and institutions matter a lot less. And you see this in union voters who don't just take cues from their bosses anymore, their union leaders. And so I think it would be a bad assumption to just think that all the superdelegates will go where the party in Washington wants them to go. I think it would be more competitive now than in the past.
Matt Bai is a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. He's also the author of his first book, The Argument, Billionaires, Bloggers in the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Thank you so much, Matt Bai.
Anytime, Jill. Thanks.
This is what birds sound like to 20th century composer Olivier Messiaen. That's an excerpt from the opening of Messiaen's massive piece for solo piano. It's called Catalogue d'Oiseaux, or Catalogue of the Birds. It was completed in 1958, and it runs more than 3 hours in length, and it catalogues nearly 75 species of birds. Olivier Messiaen was born 100 years ago. This year, concert halls around the world are taking note. In Boston tomorrow at the New England Conservatory, a month-long series of performances of Messiaen's piano works gets underway. Joining us to talk about Messiaen is pianist Bruce Brubaker of the New England Conservatory. Bruce, Messiaen, a Frenchman, has been referred to as the grandfather of the 20th century avant-garde. Is that an accurate description?
Well, I think he was extremely important in the middle of the 20th century because of his own music and then also through his teaching, because two of his students were Pierre Boulez and Karlheinz Stockhausen. So he really had a tremendous impact in that post-war period. You know, it's a long and complicated period, I think, in Western European and American art music. But it's also hard to imagine the kind of predicament, I think, that composers found themselves in after World War II. Boulez, at this point, made some kind of remark where he said, the only great music is music which destroys the past.
And I know Messiaen was also affected by the war. He was a prisoner of war in the French army. He was in Germany, but he also went on from there, you know, as these other artists did. And he did put birds at the center of his work, that and his faith. And there's a connection between his faith, his devotion to Catholicism, and his music. Could you explain that?
Well, it's a very powerful and intense experience to hear his music that comes from that faith. A little bit later on New England Conservatory, we're going to have a complete performance of Vingt Regards sur l'Enfant Jésus, and this is a piece which comes from this slightly earlier time in the 40s. But I think Messiaen, like other, is it fair to call them mystical Catholics, thought that the songs of birds were a voice of God, or were voices of God, and so that to be attentive in a very specific way to that singing was to hear God.
Let's listen to a little bit more of Messiaen. This is you playing Oiseaux Exotiques, or Exotic Birds, and let's listen.
This is the big cadenza from Messiaen's Oiseaux Exotiques, a piece for piano and wind instruments and percussion. And in this cadenza, we hear the catbird and the bobolink. And he is making a kind of culmination for this piece, which is a somewhat fanciful combination, I think, of birds that exist together in this work. As they could never exist in nature, because some of them are North American birds and some of them are Asian birds. And it may very well have been inspired by his trip to an exhibition d'oiseaux in Paris, a bird show, where he apparently was surrounded by a whole bunch of shamas, and the shama appears in this work as well. And it musically provides a kind of climax for this little piano concerto.
I'm really curious about Messiaen as an individual, as a man, someone who was a bird lover, an enthusiast, and actually an authority eventually on birds. How did this come about?
I think it's interesting. What you said is quite true. He eventually became an authority. So in the earliest piece bird pieces, the Réveil des Oiseaux, he was basing what he did on a trip to the forest, where he was trying to notate as quickly as he could on paper what he was hearing around him. But actually, even though this had a kind of truth about it, it wasn't perhaps the most effective thing, because he couldn't listen twice, he couldn't reflect on it. And in this piece that we just heard a little bit of, Oiseau Exotique, there was a real big development there because he was able to use field recordings, recordings which actually came from a set made for Cornell University back in the 40s, and he got a hold of these recordings. And then he was able to hear them many times, of course, and even in some cases to transcribe the very same recording in differing ways into music. So I think this was this kind of more factual approach, strangely enough, led him to more freedom. So he was really able to use the material and to create something which was both closer to the natural source and at the same time more imaginative artistically. Something that fascinates me about the way Messiaen uses the birds is that in this piece, for the first time, sometimes the birds sing slower than they really sing. And so he's able to take this material from nature and really use it just like a composer uses any kind of material. He develops it, he turns it into something else, and what started out as something copied from the sound world of a forest turns out to be a material of artistic creation.
Bruce Brubaker, you're also, in addition to being a musician, a pianist, you're a teacher. What does it mean and what is it like to teach the music of Olivier Messiaen, especially a three-hour piece like the Bird Catalog?
It's very exciting to hear our students playing this music, and I think that really for the first time the catalog of the birds is becoming a part of the repertory as some of Messiaen's other music has already become. So this is a very good place for young pianists, and in this project we are actually involving something like practically 50 students from New England Conservatory are playing this piece and several other pieces over the course of the next few weeks.
Pianist Bruce Brubaker of the New England Conservatory, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
For more on Messiaen, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, Kevin Sullivan, Emiko Tamagawa, Alex Ashlock, and Hitesh Hati. Doug Shugarts is our engineer. Our web producer is Ken George. We receive technical help from Vince Fairchild and Jared Mooney. Our interns are Kate Tai and Lisa Tobin. Our managing editor is Chris Ballman, and the senior producer of Here and Now is Kathleen McKenna. I'm Jill Kaufman. Robin Young returns tomorrow. Please join us again, Here and Now. Thank you.